From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. We are about to enter a third year of this pandemic, but you already knew that. Yesterday, the seven-day average of new coronavirus cases in this country topped 265,000 per day. That's according to Johns Hopkins, and that is a record. The number of COVID patients in hospitals is also rising in states like Indiana. There, the Biden administration has sent members of the military to help out hospitals. Let's check in now with registered nurse Katie Howe. She directs emergency and trauma services at Indiana University Health. That is the state's largest hospital system. Katie, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Now, statewide in Indiana, hospitalization numbers are rising for COVID patients. What do they look like at your ER right now?
In our ER in Bloomington, Indiana, we are seeing an increase of COVID-19 positive patients from those that are walking in just nervous because they've been exposed all the way up to those that are being admitted to our ICUs. We are anticipating even more in the next coming weeks. We have been in this Delta surge now, and Omicron is quickly approaching our area.
And what is the profile of the COVID patients you're seeing? Are they younger, older? Are they sicker? Are they vaccinated or no?
You know, it's kind of all over the board. We are not admitting a lot of pediatric patients. They're being seen mainly for low-grade fevers and family exposures. You know, our elderly population and those that are not vaccinated tend to be the sickest. At our hospital in particular, a majority of our patients that are hospitalized, close to 90% of them, are not vaccinated. And those that are vaccinated and hospitalized usually have a mixture of other comorbidities that are coming along with COVID-19 exacerbations.
All right. And can I ask about the staff situation? I read that IU Health intensive care doctor Gabriel Boslett recently told lawmakers that hospitals are bursting, that it's not the ICU beds, it's not the ventilators, it's not enough staff. How does that square with what you're seeing?
I will say, from my perspective, we are not closing any beds due to staffing. While we do have a nursing shortage that was evident even before the pandemic started, we are exploding with patients, but it's really not just a staffing issue that's contributing to that. It is truly the sheer volume of patients.
Well, when you put that together, the volume of patients and the staffing challenges you're describing, and adding on top of that, we are 2 years into this pandemic, surely your staff is exhausted.
Yeah, you said it well. And that's exactly what it is. You know, a lot of people will call it burnout. I don't really liken that word, because as nurses, we're called to do this work. And it truly is exhaustion. We are exhausted from many different levels. And, you know, we talk a lot in healthcare about compassion fatigue, and not so much compassion fatigue when it comes to our patients and their families. It seems to me what I see out of my nurses and what I've experienced myself is while we're working with these patients, we are giving and giving and giving our all to them. And by the time we get home at night, you know, that's when the compassion fatigue sets in, and our families are experiencing that. You know, I'll get home and I have 4 children. And I'm a single mom. And so, of course, when I get home, they're like, "Mom, we need to do this. Mom, mom, mom." And it's like, you're just on complete sensory overload when you get home. And it's almost like you just have nothing more to give. And then, you know, the other place we see it come out is sometimes in team dynamics, right? We can get snarky with one another. And sometimes we have to check each other and go, "Whoa, do you need to step away and take a break?" The public is exhausted too. And that feeds into this as well. They're frustrated. They want to be seen quickly, but we just can't move them through the emergency department in a manner that meets their expectations. And so nursing and physicians and providers are taking a lot of verbal abuse as well. And so it's a tough, tough environment for sure.
Yeah. Well, you sure put a picture on the reality. Can I ask you about the virus risk to nurses? The CDC, as you know, recently shortened the quarantine isolation period for nurses and other healthcare workers from 10 days to 7 days. And workers who are boosted don't even have to quarantine, according to the guidance. The nurses' union says this is unsafe for nurses. Do you hear about this kind of fear from many nurses around you?
I do not. I feel like the nurses that I lead and that I work alongside with have a really good understanding about the virus and how it spreads. So while it is concerning to shorten a quarantine, I think if we use the guidance and, you know, you're asymptomatic and you're not running a fever, you know, it makes good sense. And that's kind of the stance that we've taken here. We have not had a large number of team members out with COVID-19. A majority of our team members are vaccinated. Also, we have plenty of PPE. I think everybody is doing a really good job, doing the best that they can.
Katie Howe is a registered nurse and director of emergency and trauma services at Indiana University Health. Katie, thank you for the time.
You're more than welcome. Anytime.
2 years into this pandemic, some of us still have our jobs and some of us can do them from home. But what about entry-level workers joining the workplace for the first time, perhaps remotely? Let's bring in Mark Stewart. He's a business and economics reporter in New York. Mark, welcome back.
Hi, Scott. It's good to be here.
Good to have you again. Now, younger workers are tech savvy in general to do this work from home thing, but surely there are challenges. What did you hear from entry-level workers in your reporting?
Yeah, indeed, Scott. And I really wanted to get a frontline perspective. So I recently talked to a young woman named Sarah McVane. She's in her 20s, and she recently started as a software developer for Encompass Technologies in Colorado. And Sarah's had a bit of an advantage. She was an intern with the company, and she actually comes into the office. Still, when she goes into work, her workspace can be pretty empty. Here's part of our conversation.
It has definitely been tricky, especially just trying to like learn the ropes of a new job when you really don't have the ability to just like walk over to someone at their desk next to you and ask them questions. You really have to like be proactive in reaching out to try to get those answers.
We think there's a big tech advantage with this generation, yet by now, everyone knows how to do a video call by now. But Scott, think about your first job. I mean, so much of our early success comes from observing others, seeing how people handle clients or a crisis. And this may be getting lost in many cases.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I'm thinking about that. And I remember, and this is still important today, reading body language, eye contact, going to coffee with a colleague or a manager. I mean, Mark, this conversation between us, right, would be so much better in person. So surely something is getting lost for all workers, but particularly for the new workers.
Absolutely. And Sarah was fortunate because she was also able to onboard in person. But I've been thinking about this as well. I mean, starting a new job is almost like the first few days of school. I mean, you learn who you can trust, who will be the person, as you mentioned, to get coffee with. And that's in addition to the basics, like how to get from point A to point B, how the copy machine works. You know, Sarah is lucky. I mean, she feels that her company really is providing good guidance for her. But I think we will agree, it's probably a bit naive to think that all companies are able to operate at such a high level.
Well, let's talk about that. Employers, of course, are so short of workers in general in the U.S. They need them. Do you have a sense of what companies do well and not so well as far as bringing on new entry-level workers in this reality?
Well, I think the issue is this. Whenever someone is entering the workforce at a downtime, such as now, or even going back to 2008 in the financial crisis, that in itself can hinder growth. I was talking to Peter Capelli. He's from the Wharton School of Business in Pennsylvania about some of this. And he points out it's in these early years where people typically see growth in their careers. But what's happening now can negatively impact this generation. So you're talking about the things that companies can do or they're not doing. I mean, he's very concerned that workers just aren't having these casual conversations with their bosses, such as just walking down the hall or popping into an office. Yeah. That can show someone in leadership, you know, what is your range? What is your ability? I mean, think about it. These days, if you want to have a follow-up conversation with a coworker, you often have to schedule a Zoom call. And it's just, it's not organic. And that is the big opportunity that is being missed. And it's something that's very difficult for companies to try and engineer.
Mark Stewart is a business and economics reporter based in New York. Mark, thank you.
Anytime, Scott. Take care.
This year, scientists learned more about COVID as the virus continued to circulate and mutate. There were medical breakthroughs in treating other conditions and diseases, and the cicadas emerged from underground. And Perseverance landed on Mars.
Touchdown confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life.
Let's look back at some of the year's top science stories with Laura Helmuth, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. Laura, welcome.
Thanks so much, and thanks for talking about the big science stories of the year.
Here we go. Yeah, 2021 was another year dominated by COVID-19 news. We learned more about the vaccines, about new ways to treat COVID-19, and we learned more about the virus and how it's changing. What, in your view, are the biggest COVID stories of 2021?
Yeah, I think the biggest science story of the year, the biggest COVID story, possibly the biggest story in a decade, maybe the century, is the COVID vaccines. They have been so successful, just astonishingly effective at protecting people from serious outcomes and death. They perform much better than anybody really predicted or dared to hope at the beginning of the year. And that's really changed how the pandemic is playing out.
Yeah, and boy, I remember late last year when the initial numbers came out and these companies said, well, they may be 90% or so effective against COVID. And we're like, really? And here we are.
Here we are. Yeah, it's just amazing. And because it's a new vaccine technology using mRNA to create vaccines, so they've really perfected the mechanism for producing and revising these vaccines. So even though we're getting new variations with Delta and Omicron, it should be pretty straightforward to just make minor changes to these vaccines so that they'll work against the worst new virus variants as they evolve.
Wow, wouldn't that be great news? In other news of vaccines, this year the first ever malaria vaccine was approved by the World Health Organization. How big a deal is that?
Oh, this is huge. And, you know, I take it back. Maybe these two stories together are the biggest stories of the decade,
A1,
possibly
A2.
The century. Yeah, this is quite a double. It's astonishing. So people have been trying for decades to figure out how to create a vaccine for malaria. And it is so much harder than creating a vaccine for a bacterial disease or for a virus, because the malaria parasite is a whole organism. It's really complicated. And it has all these different stages of its life cycle. And it lives in the blood. It lives in the liver. It's just really hard to find and hard for the immune system to stop it. And so it was really hard to come up with a vaccine that worked. And finally, we have one. You know, it's been in the works. It's been through clinical trials. And there are others that are in the works that seem to be even more effective. And none of these are quite as effective as the COVID vaccines. But they seem to really, really be able to protect, especially children, from coming down with this terrible disease.
Now, there were also some very promising, kind of amazing CRISPR advances this year, that's genome editing, to treat blindness and to treat sickle cell anemia. Tell us, I guess, first of all, a little bit about how this works and what the breakthroughs this year were.
Yeah, the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing system, the discoverers of this, won the Nobel Prize just last year in 2020. It's not that old a discovery. And from the beginning, scientists were saying, okay, well, it looks like this is something that could very precisely change genes, especially genes that are responsible for diseases based on just a single mutation or a very simple problem in the genome. And so, yeah, this year we have some of the first results showing that the technique can be used safely and apparently effectively to treat sickle cell disease. It's been used in another blood disease called beta thalassemia, and then a really nasty disease called transthyretin amyloidosis. And it's a fatal condition, and there was a trial using CRISPR-Cas9 to protect people from this, basically a misfolded protein that causes terrible disease and death. So they're all still early stages. We're talking like dozens of people in the trials, but it looks very promising that this is a technique that could be safe and effective. There have been no serious side effects reported so far to treat diseases that start from basic genetic mutations.
Okay, to the natural world we go, where I live just outside of Washington, D.C. The buzz and the buzz of the cicadas was the sound of the summer. The Brood X emerged this year, and those of us who kind of live in a certain part of the country, we just remember how these, I don't know, these carcasses of cicadas just surrounded these giant maple trees in the neighborhood. What did we learn about the cicadas this year?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, these bugs spent 17 years underground waiting to emerge by the billions. And as you heard, they were so loud. They were just buzzing and shrieking and bouncing against things all summer long. So we learned, you know, a lot about their life cycle. Every time they emerge, scientists get really excited. And so this year especially, they were studying this nasty fungus that infects male cicadas and causes their genitals to fall off. But the males still try and mate with the female cicadas who are trying to mate with them. And unfortunately, this spreads the fungus and causes a lot of dead cicadas. They were going to die anyway, but unfortunately, they die before they can, you know, do what they were waiting 17 years to do, which is reproduce and lay their eggs. So that was kind of gross, but interesting.
Yep.
And there's a lot of new research on how the tunnels they dig in the ground as they're emerging have changed how water percolates through the soil. So they just have this huge effect, and especially on any birds or like chipmunks and squirrels that eat insects, they had a really good year because there were just so many, you know, fat, juicy cicadas to dine on.
Too many for I mean, for that period of time where it was just as the only thing you could see, step on, look at. Okay, Mars in 2021. Let's go there. There were Mars quakes, for one. What happened, and what do we learn about that?
Yeah, the Mars quakes are cool. We've learned so much about Mars in the past few years. We've heard the first sounds of the Martian atmosphere and the wind and storms whipping across Mars's atmosphere, which is much thinner than ours. And in February, the Mars Perseverance rover, which is nicknamed Percy, landed in Jezero Crater, which is a big crater on Mars that has a river delta. So an ancient river used to flow there, and it created a delta just like you'd see at the end of the Mississippi River. And so this little rover is just trundling along in this crater and taking soil samples. It's collecting them, which someday we'll try to figure out a way to send them back to Earth, and analyzing, just like a little geologist, a cute little robotic geologist, it's analyzing the rocks. Some of the scientists on the Perseverance mission reported that the rocks that they're sampling are actually from an ancient lava flow. They thought they might have been sedimentary rocks put there by the ancient lake bed, ancient river delta, but it looks like it was a great big magma flow, like from a volcano. So that was kind of cool. And then this, as part of this mission, there's a helicopter called Ingenuity, which, you know, one of the nice things about NASA, they always have very inspirational, aspirational names for their projects.
Cool names.
It's very cool names. Yeah, so this helicopter has flown. Yeah, it's a helicopter that we're flying on another planet, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard enough to fly a helicopter on Earth, but, you know, you're flying it with a joystick on Mars, and Mars has a very thin atmosphere, so it's hard to get the lift to make the helicopter fly, but it's been up 17 times so far, and it's sort of scouting around the crater as the rover kind of trundles along the base of this crater. So they're working as a team to explore Mars.
Wow. And rounding out the year is a big moment for NASA. The James Webb Space Telescope launched. Tell us more about that and why you're excited about it.
Oh, yes. So the James Webb Space Telescope, which a lot of astronomers are calling the Just Wonderful Space Telescope, rather than using the James Webb name and to sort of emphasize this is a really big deal. It's been in the making for about 30 years. It was initially supposed to launch in 2007, but it's complicated. It's a process. A lot of things went wrong. It's this really expensive, complicated, exciting project. It's designed to see the oldest things in the universe. So the very first stars and galaxies that formed right after the Big Bang. And it's going to have a much larger telescope. It'll have a great big mirror that has to unfold in space. So it's a really just engineeringly complicated project. And if it works, we're going to have the best understanding that we've ever had of how the universe began and what's happened in the past billions and billions of years.
You know, Laura, I hear the energy in your voice talking about all of these stories. We've thrown a lot at you. Anything left in your notebook? Any other top science stories you want to talk about?
Oh, you know, I could talk all day. I love talking about science stories. Of course, the things that improve human health, those are the most important things. But a lot of what we just enjoy about science is understanding, you know, strange animal behavior or, you know, quirky new things. And one of the things I've gotten a kick out of is a study this year on kind of lemur called Indri lemurs. And it turns out they're the only primates besides humans known to have a sense of rhythm. And scientists analyzed their songs, and they found predictable patterns both in the sequences of the sort of notes, you know, the sounds that they make, and the timing. And they matched their rhythms to sing basically with one another. And, you know, being primates, goodness. It seems like it's really cool. And the reason they do this seems to be for bonding and communication. So it's like a sweet sound, too. And it kind of reminds us of why we sing together.
Laura Helmuth is editor-in-chief of Scientific American. Laura, thank you and Happy New Year.
Thank you so much.
Oh, and by the way, we found the sound of those Indri lemurs singing. Wow, yeah, insert your own comment there. You can find more of that and our conversation about the biggest climate change stories of the year at hereandnow.org. This is the snowiest December on record for the Sierra Nevada mountains in the West. That's according to the University of California's Central Sierra Snow Laboratory, which measured more than 17 feet of snow so far this month. And that's enough even to overwhelm ski resorts. But the monster snowpack is also welcome news in the drought-stricken West. Andrew Schwartz is lead scientist at the Sierra Snow Lab, about a 45-minute drive from Lake Tahoe in California, at least on a normal driving day, not so much today. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm great, thank you. So that is a lot of snow in your part of the country. Some ski areas closed, highway shut down, you're not far from the Lake Tahoe area. What has it been like just trying to get around and doing your job?
It's been incredibly hazardous, to be completely honest. But one of the benefits of working in this historic lab that's been here since the 1940s is actually that it has a living quarters in it. So luckily, I haven't had to be out on the roads too much. But you're absolutely right. Just about every road on either side of us for about 30 to 40 miles has been shut down for the last 5 days.
Now, when this record snowfall started to come, surely many in your area were thanking their lucky stars after 2 years of drought. For the rest of us far away, how much does the region rely on snow to refill its reservoirs?
Yeah, so snowfall in California accounts for about 30% of total water for the state. You know, obviously it all comes in the winter, but if we get really good snowpack seasons, it can hang around until July or even August. So it's incredibly exciting to see this big record-breaking snowfall in December.
Yeah. And given the patterns of climate change we've seen, is this kind of feast-famine thing going to be a pattern in the future? You know, not enough snow for a big long stretch and then suddenly snow and snow everywhere?
Like you said, we kind of have these large variability and this large swing even from month to month right now. And that's a characteristic signal of climate change. While we're definitely hoping that we may see more snow in the upcoming months to help us out with this drought, it could very well be that we don't. And then we go back to that famine, and this may all be for naught. So we're really kind of crossing our fingers that the upcoming months are just as wet and snowy as December has been.
Yeah. And let me ask you to look further out. Many scientists are predicting that later this century, there might effectively be zero snowpack in some of the Western mountains. What would that mean for water resources and for wildfire risk?
Realistically, with the patterns that we're seeing up here on the summit, you know, we're seeing warming temperatures, and we're actually seeing a lot of that snow transition to rain, which would be expected from those warmer temperatures. But we're also seeing a little bit extra precipitation overall. So the real kind of story for us up here is that we're seeing more precipitation overall, which would be beneficial for the water resources here in California, but it's not a snowpack, which means those fires will really ravage anywhere with trees just about every summer. And so that's definitely a concern. It really just comes down to, will we be able to accurately manage that additional precipitation that we get in terms of trying to make it work with our water resources?
Andrew Schwartz is manager and lead scientist at the Sierra Snow Lab near Lake Tahoe. Andrew, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate it.
One industry that has long understood climate change and its risk is the insurance business. After all, they are on the hook for extreme events. And it turns out you can buy a policy to insure nature, as in a coral reef in Mexico. So let's tell you about the first of its kind. Last year, Hurricane Delta slammed the Mesoamerican reef in Quintana Roo, Mexico. And in a jiffy, local officials got a check for $850,000. So how's this work? Well, let's revisit a conversation I had in November with Michael Beck. He's research professor at UC Santa Cruz and former lead marine scientist at the Nature Conservancy. Mike, thanks for taking a little time away to be with us.
Hi, Scott. Glad to be here.
Now, let's talk about this reef in Mexico. It is the second largest in the world after the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. You've been going there for more than 30 years. What is the climate impact?
Well, you're seeing really strong impacts to the reef there. I've been going there, as you said, since 1988, and the reef was in incredible shape then. But it's been facing many kinds of challenges: ocean warming, pollution, coastal development. So we've been losing quite a bit of the coral cover and the reef structure. So you have this reef that's been secreting all of this limestone over decades and centuries, and it's growing up this wall, and it's got a thin living skin of coral on top of it. And that's all the color that you see on a reef. As that reef dies, you're losing that topmost corals, maybe a meter, sometimes 2 meters of coral at the top, but you're still preserving at least some of the underlying structure. And that's really important because reefs break waves. And the taller the reef is, the more waves they break and the less flooding that there is on shore.
Okay, so let's talk about this insurance experiment. I understand the Nature Conservancy is teamed up with the insurance giant Swiss Re and some other parties. Give us the basics of how this insurance works.
Well, the core of insurance like this is to understand, what's the likelihood of damage to reefs from storms? And we have some understanding of the relationship between wind speed and wave height and the damage to these reefs. And so you're developing a policy that recognizes when storms reach certain intensities, they're going to damage reefs, and we're going to need some sort of access to funding to be able to quickly repair them.
Right. And so I guess as far as this insurance policy, who paid for the policy? And then after Hurricane Delta came, how quickly did the money come?
Yeah, so there are a variety of parties who are paying into the insurance policy per se. That includes the Conservancy, who has interests in preserving the reef, the government, because it's important for lives and livelihoods, the protections that the reefs offer, as well as other businesses. So those are the folks paying in. The money in this instance came in about 20 days, is my understanding. And this is really important because we've got about 2 weeks or a little bit more to do some of the most important work to recover those reefs.
So tell us a little bit about how that quick recovery went. I understand very quickly dive instructors went down, fishermen, researchers. In this case, you think it went well?
Well, I think the first phase of that did go very well and as planned. And then you've got the harder and longer work of then assessing, are there areas where we lost corals that we weren't able to put them back quickly? And so we need to do further reef restoration work.
Yeah. And finally, I do want to ask another question on these reefs around the world. My jaw dropped when I read that up to 90% of coral reefs could be damaged by 2040. For the rest of us, how urgent is this problem?
Well, I think the problem is really urgent. We showed in our work that if we lose just the topmost meter of reefs, the costs of storms are going to double. Reefs are really effective at protecting us. They reduce 97% of the wave energy that would otherwise impact coastlines. So we've got to act quickly to make sure that we preserve those living corals on the top of our natural seawalls.
That's Michael Beck. He's research professor at the Institute of Marine Sciences at UC Santa Cruz. Michael, thanks for your insights.
Thank you, Scott.
Okay, we just heard about coral reef insurance in Mexico. It's an example of what is called parametric insurance. To translate and explain how it can help people after natural disasters, we have Carolyn Kuski, Executive Director of the Wharton Risk Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Carolyn, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, parametric insurance, right, a mouthful. How is it different from standard insurance? Say, hurricane comes, an insurance company sends an adjuster to my home, assesses the damage, and eventually, someday, they might decide to send me a check.
Exactly. With a parametric policy, the payout is only related to some independent measure of the disaster itself. So the amount you get might be based on how fast the winds were blowing at a particular location or when a flood gauge reaches a certain stage. So it's not related to your damage, which might make you wonder why you'd be interested in such a policy, but there are a number of advantages.
I see. Okay, right. And so the advantages here to this kind of insurance are what?
Yeah, so there's essentially two big advantages. The first is that the payout can be made much faster. So anyone who's argued with their insurance company about how much they're owed knows that that loss adjustment process can take a while, and it can slow down getting the financial resources that people need for their recovery. With one of these parametric products, since it's some observable measure of the hazard that can be undertaken immediately, payouts can be made in a matter of days. So that's benefit number one.
So automatic, the insurance company doesn't need to send anybody out. They just look and say, we just had a 80 mile per hour, 100 mile per hour, whatever the agreed upon magnitude that was triggered, then the payout is triggered.
Exactly. So it's fast and hopefully pretty easy.
So how is it being used now in parts of the world that perhaps seem promising to you, perhaps farmers or for people who live in hurricane areas?
Yeah, I think there's two uses that have shown to be really helpful. One, as you said, is to help lower income groups and others who are traditionally locked out of insurance markets get access to coverage. Because of these efficiencies, the transaction costs of these policies are a lot lower. And so you can write smaller policies. So often with traditional insurance, it's not profitable to write small policies for lower coverage amounts. But with parametric insurance, you can. So yes, it's been used around the world for small landholders, livestock owners, for actually a range of types of losses. And we're just now starting to see that come to the U.S.
So how about in this country? I understand you're working on a pilot.
Yeah, so we're working on a pilot in New York City with the Mayor's Office of Climate Resiliency and the Center for New York City Neighborhoods. And the idea is to help bring some of these models to the U.S. to help with the disaster recovery of low and moderate income families here. And the way we're structuring this is not as a direct-to-household type of insurance policy like we've been talking about, but something that's referred to actually as a mezzo insurance policy, so more jargon. But the basic idea is that the Center for New York City Neighborhoods, this NGO, is going to purchase a parametric insurance policy itself. And so when a big flood comes, it will trigger this policy. And then the Center for New York City Neighborhoods will have the money to make emergency cash grants to households in need after a flood event.
So what are the challenges of this kind of disaster parametric insurance? I imagine some people, as you said, they can't afford it. Some people perhaps may assume, you know, the government is going to take care of me, so why buy it?
Yeah, and we know that actually at any income level, it's really hard to get people to want to buy insurance for disasters. They seem unlikely when it's a lovely day outside. And also, insurance is a really not a fun product to buy. It's something that you buy and you hope you never have to use. And nobody likes that, right? So it's very difficult to motivate people to think about if this worst case happens, that it's important to have that financial protection. We know that people tend to be too optimistic about these things, unfortunately leaving them exposed when the disaster does occur.
Carolyn Kuski, Executive Director of the Wharton Risk Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Carolyn, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Former Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid has died. He was 82. Reid was born into poverty in a small Nevada mining town, and yet he rose to lieutenant governor before becoming a kingmaker in Washington, D.C. For more, we are joined by John Ralston at the Nevada Independent. He followed Reid's career. John, hello.
Hi there.
Now, Harry Reid is remembered for where I am in D.C., for what he did as the top Democrat in the Senate. But he also towered in Nevada politics. Can you tell us a little bit how it started for him?
Well, I mean, he started more than 50 years ago in politics by getting elected to an obscure body that was the head of a public hospital trustee board. And he, from there, he went into the state legislature and then, as you mentioned, a lieutenant governor. He tried to get to Washington way back in the mid-1970s when he ran for the U.S. Senate and lost to Paul Laxalt, and then later, just 6 months later, tried to run for Las Vegas mayor in an ill-advised comeback, and his career was thought to be over, but his standing was resurrected by his mentor, the then-governor Mike O'Callaghan, who appointed him to the State Gaming Commission, which oversees the casinos, and from there, he used that as a springboard to go to Congress, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. Well, Reid was an amateur boxer and a bit of a political pugilist, too. He made enemies, including the mob, which almost killed his wife in a car bombing when Reid chaired the Nevada Gaming Commission, as you described. Does this go to how his personality was, how he did his politics?
He was a very, very tough human being. His whole character, I think, was forged in that tiny town you mentioned called Searchlight, Nevada, where he grew up in a place without indoor plumbing, had to hitchhike to high school, and really, I think, was always running away from that, even though it was so much imbued in him. He was going to be better than the town in which he grew up. And so I think his toughness and his grit came from that, his willingness to take on the mob, his willingness to take on causes no one else would, his willingness, sometimes to his detriment, to say things no one else would say.
In Congress, Harry Reid was a staunch advocate for Nevada businesses, particularly the mining industry. How is he being remembered by Nevadans today?
You know, you bring up a great part of his career, his advocacy for the mining industry. What other politician could you name who would be an advocate for mining and yet be remembered as one of the great environmentalists? That is the proudest part of his record. But he was able to navigate through corporate chieftains, whether they were in mining or gaming or other industries, and still be an advocate for progressive causes like public lands and renewable energy and other such things. And so he had a unique ability to be able to relate to environmentalists and heads of mining companies, and both liked him. I mean, that is really, when you think about it, remarkable.
Hmm. Now, in Washington, Harry Reid played a pivotal role in getting a junior senator from Illinois to run for president. And then when Barack Obama was elected, he worked with him to pass the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Let's listen.
Progress and opportunity are what this historic bill represents. To those who so admirably care so much for their fellow man that they demand more, I say, this is just the beginning.
So when you think about Harry Reid's other legislative accomplishments, what comes to mind?
Well, he focused mainly, and I'm writing a book about him, and I did some interviews with him over the last few months of his life, and he is really, really proud of the Affordable Care Act, but I think he's also very, very proud of his legacy on the environment and in public lands and water issues. And of course, the biggest environmental issue that could have threatened Nevada, putting nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain, which is only 90 yeah. miles from Las Vegas. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the nuclear waste would be in Nevada right now if it weren't for Harry Reid ascending to the Senate Majority Leader's post, and that's how he stopped it.
Now, Harry Reid, as a Senate leader, also notably blew up the filibuster rules for judicial appointments in 2013. He did that after Republicans consistently blocked the Obama nominees. This, of course, came back to bite the Democrats. His Republican counterpart, Mitch McConnell, not only pushed judges through by a simple majority vote, but also Supreme Court justices. But Reid, he stood by that decision, yeah?
He had absolutely no regrets about that whatsoever. Not only did he say he needed to do it to save the Obama presidency, he said that was not an overstatement, but he suggested that Mitch McConnell would have done what he did, whether or not Reid had gone nuclear first, so to speak. So he did not regret it. He was quite upset during a few of our interviews, though, with how some of the Democratic senators seemed to have amnesia about how all that happened, and now we're taking a different position.
That is John Ralston of the Nevada Independent talking about Harry Reid. John, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.